Thanks, Steve and Pete, for reading the Bible so well. My name's Rob Imberger. I'm part of the staff team here in this church. I have the privilege of finishing off the story that you heard started last week. There are quite a few loose ends. Bear with us. If you weren't here last week, it's okay. I'm going to do a bit of a recap. Even if you were here last week, it's such a flippin' good story that I don't think you'll mind hearing it again. Basically, let me take you through a very quick tour of Esther chapters 1 to 4. Will help you understand the book as we look at 5 to 10 this week. So there's a king, Xerxes. He's vain and proud. He throws a massive party and wants to tell everyone, hey, I'm famous, I'm rich, I'm important. This kind of cream on the cake, the kind of icing on the cake for him was to bring his wife in, called Queen Vashti. And he would think to himself, he'd show off his beautiful wife in front of all these mates, and he'd think, oh, I am a man. I am a man. So, the only hitch was, she refused to come. Very humiliating for this king when the queen decides to refuse him. So in the end, Queen Vashti has refused and is dethroned as queen. King Xerxes gets so angry at her, actually decrees that all wives should submit to their husbands as a result of his wife's insubordination. The better kind of alternative the better outcome for King Xerxes was, his advisors said, hey, how about we get countless young virgins and you can choose one of them as your wife? He took that advice, it pleased the king. And then Xerxes saw Esther, this beautiful, surpassingly wondrous woman, whom he took as his wife, crowned her to be queen. Esther, we learn, is an orphan. A Jew as well, but she keeps that a secret. We also learn that her cousin Mordecai uncovers a conspiracy against the king. A couple of angry young men, we don't know why, but they get really, really excited and want to kill the king. Mordecai overhears this, passes this news on. It ends up getting uncovered. The king's life is saved. Again, Esther and Mordecai play a really important role there. And it all kind of seems good. It seems like there was a rags-to-riches story unfolding, you know, orphan Esther made into queen, Mordecai has done a really noble thing, but then there's a real kind of hitch. Haman, this ruler, comes on the scene, takes like a prime minister role underneath King Xerxes, and he is decreed that everyone should bow down and pay him honour. But Mordecai doesn't. Haman kind of wanders the streets, and Mordecai refuses to bow down and pay Haman honour. It's because he's a Jew. That is, he believes in one true God and none other. He won't bow down and pay honour to any human. That gets Haman really upset. So he decrees that not just one Jew, but all Jews should die. And it gets decided that that's going to happen. The edict is written. This is in, say, month number one. The edict is issued so that the genocide takes place in month number 12. So there's an 11-month gap. And Mordecai is understandably quite upset. All the Jews are understandably quite upset. And it's all that he can do to go to his cousin Esther and say, hey, since you're a queen, can you please intercede for us? Can you please do something? Can you talk to your husband? Can you plead on our behalf? Otherwise, we're dead. And Esther finishes a little kind of exchange of back and forth, back and forth. She says to Mordecai, hey, pray for me, fast for me. If I perish, I perish. I'll talk to the king. If I perish, I perish. That's where we left everything, right? And so it's a cliffhanger. What's going to happen? I mean, it's a noble kind of plan from Esther. But is it going to succeed? It's a selfless plan. Is it going to succeed? It's an amazing story, really, just to take a step back, just so far in hearing that summary. It's got everything. It's got sex and power and intrigue and irony and twists and turns and so much. But who tells it? That's the question I want to ask this morning. Who tells the story makes all the difference, doesn't it? So we have our daughter Evie is really obsessed with the Wiggles at the moment. So she's got a book and she rushes up to her and goes, and it's like this, we read it 10 times a day. It's not that kind of exciting as a story, I must say. After the third time round, you get a bit sick of it. But in any case, We read it, we tell it with the right emphasis, we tell it with the right pauses. It really matters that we tell her this Wiggles story. If she kind of gave it to anyone else, it wouldn't have the same ring to it. They wouldn't know exactly how to phrase things. Who tells the story matters a lot. And that's like that with Esther. This is, sure, an amazing story about Queen Esther, but could it be told by just anyone? I don't think so. I think only God can tell this story. This is really important when we read Old Testament narrative or stories, because it's really hard to get a 3-point sermon application out of this story. It's really hard to pronounce some of the names. It's really hard to kind of punch through the mystery of it. And we can kind of think, oh, well, this story, this Old Testament narrative has no meaning for me. Or, oh, gosh, I can't even hear God speaking to me. It's so cloaked in all this other historical stuff. But we need to remember who's telling this story. If we remember, this is God himself telling this story. That it's no less than God speaking. Just because it's in a story and not Jesus saying, hey, you got to do this, it's still his voice. This is still God speaking to you and me. And that's really important in the book of Esther, because God is not named anywhere in this book. You won't find him. Oh, sorry, I should be more precise. You won't find him named anywhere. But don't think he's not there. God's all over this story. God's at work so much in this story. He's doing hidden work most of the time. God's doing hidden work most of the time. And by the way, I'm about to go off on a bit of a tangent, but I credit my old Ridley College principal, Peter Adam, for this. He's just done some wonderful work in the book of Esther, and I'm stealing it right from him. So I make that disclaimer. He talks about the hiddenness of God, and he asks the question, what is it about the hiddenness of God that we find hard to understand? If God is hidden, he doesn't visibly appear, if he doesn't audibly appear in the book of Esther, if that irks us, if that puzzles us, if that offends us, why? How do you feel about that? The fact that God doesn't actually appear visibly, audibly in this book? Does it annoy you? Does it intrigue you? Do we expect him all the time to be doing big, extraordinary things? Do we expect ourselves to be able to see what he's doing all the time, and that it just has to be obvious to our plain eye? Do we get hungry for spectacular things and we forget the simple things? I remember a while ago, you know, when the Shroud of Turin was being discovered or manufactured, whichever two, and you get this extraordinary tale where, it's just, you know, the towel, whatever it was, that meant to have the face of Jesus on it. And I remember someone saying around that time, I really hope it doesn't prove to be real. I really hope that it's proved to be a fake, because you know what will happen when that gets authenticated? People are going to flock to it and start worshipping it. It's going to become an idol. People are going to bow down to this thing that they think that Jesus put on his face at some point, and it's going to become more important than God. I think that's a really good point. And it's a really good point for the book of Esther when God's not named. Because consider this. By not visibly appearing, by refusing to be, in a sense, a puppet on a string, God frees us from boxing him. In other words, if God did only things that are extraordinary all the time, we could think, oh, well, that is definitely God. I've worked him out. And if that's not happening, then that's not God. I've figured that out. But by doing hidden stuff and stuff we've got no idea about, and small things as well as big things, God frees us from making him an idol to bow down to, that we construct ourselves. He's doing hidden small stuff all the time. Think of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. That's what Psalm 19 says. The heavens declare the glory of God. That's happening right now. You might not look for it. You might not expect it. But the heavens are declaring glory of God. There they are. He's just at work in the ordinary thing, doing extraordinary stuff right now. Well, take Colossians 1:17. It says that Jesus, in Jesus, all things hold together. In Jesus, all things hold together. That's happening right now. God is working through His Son, Jesus, to give you breath in your lungs, to keep you alive, to keep this church together, to keep your faith intact, to give you senses in your body. So you probably weren't looking for it, but that's God's hidden work. There He is. So no, He doesn't visibly or audibly appear in the book of Esther. But the truth is God works in lots of ways all the time in the book of Esther. Just, you've seen it just already. In that summary I gave of chapters 1 to 4, I mean, think of the coincidences. Esther just happens to be beautiful enough to become queen and beat all the other queens, potential queens. Mordecai just happens to be at the king's gate when he overhears a story, a plan to overthrow the king. The genocide has 11 months to go from issue of decree till actual genocide. I mean, that's a lot of time for things to change. Esther is able to speak to the king. That's extraordinary. No commoner was allowed to speak to the king. There's no way that she would be able to speak to her husband, the king, if she were not queen. Now we get to see a whole lot more of God working the story. This is chapters 5 to 10. Please have it open as I go through. I need to summarize bits and pieces. You heard little bits read out, but I need to summarize others. In chapter 5, it's fair to say things seem to get better, but then they get a whole lot worse. Esther, she does secure an audience with the king. She invites him to a banquet. That's a good deal. She's a wise woman. Feed him, get him drunk. He'll be more amenable to my request. She hosts it's a two-part banquet, so we learn that there's two nights to it. And then we learn that she's gonna make her plea to pardon for the Jews during that banquet. And the king gets a little bit loose in his lips. He says, "Oh, what do you want? You can have half of my kingdom. Whatever you want, beautiful woman." And Esther does a funny thing. She invites Haman to the banquet. Now that's a tactical move right there. Because, you know, vain, proud, arrogant men don't like competition, do they? So Haman, second in charge, comes along with Xerxes and Esther. Esther knows it's going to cause some friction. There's going to be some competition. We also learn that she invites Haman along. So when she gets around to pleading for the Jews, it'll come out that she's a Jew, and then she'll say, "Yeah, and Haman's going to destroy all of us." Wow. You can see what she's doing there. How on earth will the king sanction the death of his wife? Very clever. She waits until the next night, so this is the second part of the banquet, to finish off her grand plan. So she's done nothing to actually plead yet. Here it comes on the second night. But that's the good part. We think it's going better, but then things go bad. On the way home from the banquet, Haman butts up against Mordecai again. Mordecai refuses to bow down and pay him honor. Mordecai gets so angry that he decides, this is chapter 5, verse 12 to 14, Listen to his arrogance, how egocentric he is. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she's invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction. As long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate." His wife's Suresh and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows built 70 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy." This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. See, the invitation to the banquet has gone to Haman's head. He thinks, "Oh, I'm so powerful, I can just ask for the king to kill Mordecai and it'll be done for me." This is bad. This thing's resolving very quickly, because now we've got two plans running parallel alongside each other. We've got Haman's plea to execute Mordecai, and we've got Esther's plea for pardon. But it's late. Nothing can be done now. We have to wait till tomorrow. Which brings us to Esther 6. And a curious little incident at bedtime. You heard this read out. A sleepless night to the king leads to a bedtime story. He chooses, of all things, wouldn't be my choice, but he gets the history books out. He wants to hear about what's been going on in his kingdom for the last little while. Which story just happens to be plucked from those pages? we heard that it was the story of how Mordecai uncovered the plot to kill the king. Now this is God at work in the story. Let me tell you why. Back in chapter 2, we learned that verse 23, when the report was investigated, this is a report about the potential assassination, and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. All this was recorded where? In the book of the annals or the history books in the presence of the king. But God is good. So he knew that that information, that little administrative tidbit, although it seemed significant, insignificant and seemed kind of meaningless at the time, needed to be in that book to get read out by the king who remembers. And then we get this extraordinary little rest of chapter 6. So many ironies ensue. Xerxes, he must have forgotten that his life got saved or something, because he kind of wakes up to the fact that, oh, Mordecai saved me, I better do something to honour him. In the morning, Haman's on his way to ask for Mordecai's death, and he's so arrogant, the king goes, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honour? Haman thinks, oh, he's thinking about me. So I'll suggest all sorts of lavish things with horses and parades and kingly robes. All the while he's thinking, oh yeah, I'm catering my own party here. This is good. We're going to look forward to this. And then comes this delicious irony. Mordecai is the one whom the king wishes to honour, not Haman. It's Haman who has to parade Mordecai around on a horse in lavish royalty. This dead man walking, he should be dead. He's being paraded around by his would-be executor. Haman is bowing down to Mordecai, not the other way around. Who'd have thought that? And Zeresh, Haman's wife, sums it up really quite perfectly. This is chapter 6, verse 13. Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, she knows what's going on, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. So this man who seemed doomed is now unstoppable. But it's not over yet. There's a banquet to go to. In chapter 7, the attention gets back on Esther. Will her plan to plead for the Jews' lives succeed? Well, there's more food, there's more wine, and then finally she gets the request. This is verses 3 to 4 of chapter 7. If I have found favour with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life, this is my petition, and spare my people, this is my request. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, but no such distress would justify disturbing the king. It goes on, King Xerxes gets upset, he's like, who's done this thing? And it ends up being Haman, obviously, and so King Xerxes rushes out, he's just furious, and you get the feeling Haman knows exactly what's going on. He knows his days are numbered, so he pleads with the queen, please intercede for me now, haha, the irony, please intercede for me now, and may I be pardoned from death. And he's so positioned when King Xerxes, in his line of sight, comes in. Haman is so positioned on the couch that Esther and him look like they're having some dodgy stuff go on, and so King Xerxes, again, quite jealous, quite a vain, proud man, gets so angry that he's like, well, that's it, kill him right now, and he does, on the very gallows that was prepared for Mordecai. God's at work in this story. It's a huge turnaround, and yet still not over. We all know the phrase, written in the laws of the Medes and Persians. What it means is that something can't be changed. If something's written in the laws of the Medes and Persians, it's irreversible, irrevocable. It comes from this story. That's where it comes from. See, when an edict was issued by the king in this time, the laws of the Medes and Persians, it would be unchangeable. So it wasn't that suddenly the Jews would be forgiven and freed and the plea would go ahead. The problem actually remains. The edict has been issued for the genocide of the Jews. It can't be changed. In fact, we get the feeling, looking at King Xerxes, that once his anger had subsided, which is what it says at the end of chapter 7, the king's fury subsides. Once that is over, he sort of forgets Esther's request. Esther's asked for clemency, for pardon. But he kills Haman, and then he gives Mordecai a promotion, and he gives Esther some money. It's kind of like he's just like a kid with a new toy. He's going, oh, that's been fun for a little while, but now I'm done with it. The problem still remains. So another plan is devised. We get verse 3 of chapter 8. Esther pleads with the king, falls at his feet, weeps, begs him to put an end to the evil of Haman. So the plan is still on. What's going to happen? Well, verses 11 onwards tell us, this is chapter 8, verse 11. The king's edict, this is a new edict, granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and their children. Goes on down the bottom. The Jews, for the Jews it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews. So basically, this amounts to a full pardon. The order for the genocide can't be changed, but another order has gone out. Rather than being sitting ducks, waiting for death, the Jews are allowed to fight back. And they do. That's what chapters 9 and 10 are all about. They fight back. And they win. They win convincingly. Do you see that? The people who seemed doomed are now, in fact, victorious. Now, at this point, I need to go back to something I said earlier. For all of us right now, what we do with this story next makes all the difference, because we need to decide, is this just a really interesting story with twists and turns aplenty, or is this God speaking to us? If it's just a story, then we have received our reward in full. It's just been entertaining. But if it's God speaking to us, if you decide that is it, then we've got to ask a big question. What does God want us to know? Lots. I mean, I could tell you how God exalts the proud, exalts the humble and brings down the proud. You see that in Haman. You see that in Mordecai and Esther. I could tell you how at the worst of times, God still is active. I could tell you how when we seem far away from God and when God seems far away from us, God's still there, working, active. I could tell you God so marvelously protects his people that even when we feel in this day and age that we will never be protected, we just have to remember the story of Esther. I can tell you all of that, and that will all be true, but I want to lead you to Jesus, who is the perfect Esther. If I perish, I perish. See, both Esther and Jesus wanted their deaths to be productive. They wanted to die for something, but Jesus is far better. If I perish, I perish. See, both Esther and Jesus were innocent, going to intervene on behalf of the people, but Jesus is better. Mordecai said about Esther that she was probably lifted up for such a time as this, as we just heard read out by the kids. See, both Esther and Jesus were God's appointed saviors at his appointed time, but Jesus is far better. See, Jesus is supremely better to Esther in one way that Esther can never be to us. See, in this story, God saved the people from disaster, not by sending in Esther as a sacrifice, but by defending the attackers. What Jesus does is take our curse upon himself. See, the death sentence that we earned because of our rebellion against God was more certain than any law of the Medes and Persians, that's for sure. But by his cross and by his resurrection, Jesus substitutes himself so that he gets the punishment and we get the pardon. If we were to reimagine the story, it would be like Jesus standing in that city on battle day, having ushered us away into a safe haven. He would just stand there and take it. He would face the slaughter alone so that our curse becomes his curse. He dies. We live. So whenever you read Esther next, please don't stop till it leads you to Jesus. I want to pray in his name now. Father, thank you for this story. It is amazing. It's so entertaining, so rich, such a tale of your faithfulness. It also, Lord, points us to Jesus Christ, in whom we have life because he conquered death, in whom we have freedom from the curse of our own sin because he took it on himself. Lord God, we look at the story and know that it was we deserved what the Jews were destined for, destruction. Yet because of Christ, his intervention, his substitution for us, we get what we don't deserve. Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for your grace, God. Please let this story of Esther change us. May we not just think it's been a good yarn. May we be so compelled by the fingerprints of love and grace and power and mercy at work, your work in this story and your work through Christ, that we live differently today and always. Amen.